Ron,
when you were reading last night, you had said that you had stopped writing for 20 years, and it reminded me of you know, one of my favorite poets whose work reminds me of yours, and also stopped writing for 20 years, George Offen, exactly 20 years. And same kinds of concerns for the intersections between the personal and the political, the same sort of sense of what it means to inhabit American society and all its weird contradictions. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about stopping and then starting again.
Yes, and I love Offen's work, by the way. One thing about writing and not writing, when we talk about the sources of writing, we say they're mysterious. When we talk about the sources of not writing, we say they're pathological. But in fact, they're equally mysterious. I've come up with lots of explanations to explain to myself, how did this happen? Why did this happen? The explanations conflict with each other, and they fall into two categories. One category is, I did this intentionally. I needed to put certain obstacles in my way in order to break certain habits that were driving me nuts in my work. That's one. Category number two, this is something that happened to me. This is like the perfect storm of poetry, all things converging to make it impossible for me to write. Sometimes that seems true, sometimes it does, although many of those forces were things that I created myself. I think there's more credibility for me in the former category, because for all those years I would go up into my study when I have long, long shelves of poetry from all the review copies I've got over the years and books that I buy and so forth. I've been an avid reader of poetry, but I would go into the room, I would see all my notebooks there, and I would turn around and go out the door. So that sounds intentional. I was making a decision not to write. Somehow, in my mind, I felt I had to write poems that were like this. I go shopping. I come home. I want to write a poem about going shopping because this is my life. So I write a poem about shopping. So maybe you get two or three stanzas of descriptions of things that happened while I was shopping, and then you get a stanza of illumination and comment, and then a couple stanzas at the end that kind of wrap it up, just in case you miss the point, with some kind of witty ending. There was a lot of poetry like that at the time. In the early 90s, I thought, damn it, that's the kind of poetry that I really ought to be writing, because I like the comical and I like the everyday and so forth. It turned out that it was absolutely unlike what I was coerced to do once I started, mysteriously, to get back into it. There were definitely stories in my work, but I don't think you can say that I'm a narrative poet. Narrative was dangerous because of the psychological mechanism involved, which is to use poetry to validate your life. That just can't work because it can't sustain your creativity over a long period of time. It can't. It's a mechanism that gratifies you in the moment, but the poems become predictable. There are these mechanics of vindication. It's cheap stuff, and I knew it was. And I couldn't stop doing it, so I had to put an obstacle in my way. And the obstacle that I put in my way is the whole damn world. Because I felt that every poet ultimately has to ask, what do I see into that other people only see? The obstacle that I put in my way, namely, get into the world, try to integrate yourself into actual living and not this thing in your mind which turns into poetry. That did lead me to the business world, which is pretty rough and tumble and so forth. I traveled a lot. But I worked in communications, and in communications work, you always write for someone else. You're either writing for this corporate entity, the shapeless entity, which has kind of personality, or you write for your CEO who's giving a speech. I write for this guy now. That's the distance that I feel. And having that sense of distance allows me to be really strange about myself. A poem has to be strange but lucid at the same time. That's what I strive for. I strive for the feeling of feeling unhinged. I know when I may be on the verge of doing something half-decent, when I feel unhinged. And one of the reasons why The Incentive of the Maggot and other poems tend to leap around is that when I sit down and I feel like something's happening, I get so nervous and crazy that I'll write 6 or 8 lines and then I have to get up and go downstairs and play with my dog or eat something or kiss my wife or go out in the yard, pull some weeds, then I'll go back up and write 8 or 10 more lines. Of course, by that time, I'm bringing something else back into the work. That feeling of excitement and astonishment is what I love in work that I read, these very surprising things. The poems that really work are a complete astonishment. You say, how the hell did this happen?
I liked how in Apparition of the Virgin, take something that I actually recall hearing about on the news. So it was this story about a window in a hospital where people saw an apparition of the Virgin. The mundane writer would have recited the facts of the event because they're interesting enough. It was quite strange in and of itself. And perhaps want the reader to say, see how smart I am and observant. I picked up this odd thing, and here it is. Look at it. But you went further.
Well, it isn't that I'm a particularly modest person, but I'm scared of poems. I'm scared for me. If you were to do it, I might love it. If I say, well, something very strange happened around the corner, anecdotally, it's brilliant. I know I've got a great story here. If I just proceed to describe it and then to put myself in it, I'm back all the way back to 25 years ago when I stopped writing. I'm paranoid about approaching the work that way. It isn't just a matter of taste or judgment. It's something else in my brain that goes on. Of course, another thing is that I'm a Jew, and this is a story about the appearance of the Virgin. So there's also a distancing involved there. And if I could just tell you one incredible anecdote that I had to push away is that this image was there, and people, all sorts of people started coming into this parking lot. There were Vietnamese Catholics there. There were little old Italian ladies there with rosary beads, and it was really quite startling. The image, the contours were very, very precise. It was a spooky thing. Dogs were running around, and then a second image appeared. Same level of the hospital, right around the corner, and it appeared to be an image of a fetus. Then suddenly there were people asking, well, are abortions being done in this hospital and so forth, and it went on and on for a couple of weeks. So that would have made a great short story or a poem or something like that, but I felt I had enough because I really didn't want to just tell the story of this image, but how we have a tendency to want our symbols, to want symbols, and make those symbols take the place of experience. And yet the experience of seeing a symbol itself is quite an interesting thing. So this is a poem without resolution at all. It's just about how to deal with something so startling. I mean, I felt moved, very moved, looking at this image. But at the same time, it was a goddamn circus up there.
Well, at the end you mention something that probably happened, but in a sense you draw a veil over it and call our attention to the fact that when we can't stare at the source image, we end up staring at the veil, and that ends up being what we ponder. It's not interpretation, almost the opposite. Admitting honestly your own confusions and questions that head in many different directions as you look at this thing. That seems a characteristic gesture of a lot of your poems, that don't summarize, don't simplify, allow the inherent mystery to be present and to be part of what you're experiencing.
I have a question, and that is, I don't know if it's particularly American, but the idea of this term morbid curiosity, as if there was a type of curiosity that is particularly inappropriate, and that usually refers to things like the doctor who attended Kennedy, or things like that, or even Holocaust. How much attention do we want to turn to these things? At a certain point, does it become unhealthy? Does it turn into obsession? Does it then begin to damage your current life? Or is it all sort of a fallacy of modern creation so that we don't have to face the harsh realities? We end up protecting people in a way that maybe isn't healthy. And mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could speak towards that.
It reminds me of something that occurred. I went over to see my folks. This is a few months ago. I frequently stop by. I get there in the early evening, and I walk in, and the two of them are elated because they have just seen on CNN an Airbus, a commercial jet, has come into LAX. The pilot was unable to get the landing gear down, and the plane lands safely, and it's live on TV. And they were elated because they had seen this thing, which could have been a catastrophe, which could have been another one of those images that we're drawn to of the fireball. But instead, it worked out, and now it becomes a story of the pilot is the hero and everybody's happy. I get back in my car and I'm driving home. I turn on the radio, I'm listening to the news, they're talking about this, and it said that inside the plane, the passengers were watching on their screens CNN talking about the plane coming into land. So they're just about to watch themselves become immolated, actually in their life, to see the image of themselves, the entertaining image of themselves in the media, going up in flame. That's the conundrum of the imagery. And that's what I started talking about early on in the Williams quote and the quote from Larry Levis, which is that you push back. It's what Stevens called the pressure of reality. By that he meant the sound of the media, even in the early 50s, of these things that take away your presence of mind. On the one hand, the morbidity of those images can be horrible. On the other hand, you could say that they don't show us enough about what is really happening in Iraq, that there's the repression of those images, just as in that poem, The Incentive of the Maggot, there's a repression of the images of the coffins landing at the airbase in Germany because Bush doesn't want us to see them, which is very strange because I grew up in the Vietnam generation where photojournalists were out in the field and every day we were getting the body count of how many NVA were killed and wounded, how many Americans were killed and wounded, until that came to an end. So there isn't an answer to how many images we should see or not, but we have to be damn careful because on the one hand we can become polluted, on the other hand, when truth is being repressed, there is some image that we are not allowed to see.
When I ask students, even today, who are somewhat, of course, distant from the Vietnam era, one of them, by the way, was a little confused in Granite City about what the mention of the boy who dived into the water and then lived to go on and be killed in Vietnam. They were a little confused about that. They thought that that maybe was just something you made up. And maybe you did, but it's not the kind of thing that would have to be made up because it really occurred. But when I asked them, what are the two most famous photographs of the Vietnam era, they all agree. This is an astonishing thing that everyone agrees that it's the photograph of the man who is being shot in the head and the photograph of the girl running away from her napalm village. Everyone agreed about that. Those have become the icons of that entire conflict. That strikes me as very strange that there would be such agreement about this. And I wonder then, what will be the images of the current war, or will there be any? And that brings up what you're talking about, repression of images. I wonder if we will have any. We'll just have a kind of vague dust storm memory of this thing. You know, what was it?
I noticed in the book that it's sectioned into three parts, and the first part really talks generally about the world, about your travels, and then the second part is filled with sort of these childhood poems, your memories of childhood, and the last part of the book sort of ends with these two poems with you standing in front of water. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about why you felt or chose to make the progression of the book move towards that.
I had some help in ordering this book. If you like the way it is, or if you don't like the way it is, somebody else is involved with me. Writing off Argentina was always the first poem. Most of the first section was always what that was. This book was originally 33 poems, and I think there are 29 now, so even at the end we were taking things out. So that first section was supposed to be standalone, here I am in the world, what is going on? And then after that it was a little less thematically coherent because it becomes somewhat more personal in nature and more associative. The ending, that last poem being kind of dreamy and cerebral, was suggested to me as a good way to get out instead of the poem immediately preceding, which kind of has a snapshot ending.
Last night you were talking about how when you, I wasn't sure if you were in an MFA program 20 years ago, but you talked about how this time around when you started writing again, you got it. And I wondered what you didn't get back then that you got.
Well, I got my degree in 1973. And I went out to Stanford to get this master's in writing. And Ivor Winters had died in 69, I think. But his ghost was still hovering. His good son was running the writing program. So it was as if he were there. And to this day, I have no idea why they wanted me out there, except maybe to entertain them. Because my work didn't exemplify any of the standards that were held at that time. Winters didn't like romantic poetry, and the metaphysical poets were the poets, and then there were a certain number of poets in the canon, and when memorized, Eros Tourinos by Gromitson and Simple Autumnal by Louise Bogan and Neil Whitman, but we'll take some Dickinson and Jones Very. I went into that environment, I thought it was very strange and it was very demanding, but I didn't have a teacher who took a real interest in my work. Also, in 1973, it was very politicized. In the workshops, there was a lot of raving about politics, governmental politics, racial politics. I wrote very anecdotal, short poems, and I walked out of there having done my finger exercises. I knew how to write in forms. I didn't feel that I left there with an insight into my work. That didn't stop me from starting a poetry magazine, however. Without insight into my work and without a sense of the firm identity of myself as a poet, nevertheless, I got into the poetry business. I think the poets that we remember, they die, but we still remember them, turn out to be poets who escape from a disordered identity into one that they will and consent to. And sometimes it takes some of us longer than others to arrive at a point where you can say, I'm an actual human. You know, in my 20s, I always felt like I wasn't an actual person. The way to attempt to move towards a concrete identity is to be in the world and to do things, to try to have an effect on your world and look at what those results are. Somehow or other, that led to being able to write, and I'm not sure exactly how.